The Terrible Solomons. There is no gainsaying that the Solomons are a hard-bitten bunch of islands. On the other hand, there are worse places in the world. But to the new chum who has no constitutional understanding of men and life in the rough, the Solomons may indeed prove terrible. It is true that fever and dysentery are perpetually on the walkabout, that loathsome skin diseases abound, that the air is saturated with a poison that bites into every pore, cut, or abrasion and plants malignant ulcers, and that many strong men who escape dying there return as wrecks to their own countries. It is also true that the natives of the Solomons are a wild lot, with a hearty appetite for human flesh, and a fat for collecting human heads. Their highest instinct of sportsmanship is to catch a man with his back turned, and to smite him a cunning blow with a tomahawk that severs the spinal column at the base of the brain. It is equally true that on some islands, such as Malaita, the profit and loss account of social intercourse is calculated in homicides. Heads are a medium of exchange, and white heads are extremely valuable. Very often a dozen villages make a jackpot, which they fatten moon by moon, against the time when some brave warrior presents a white man's head, fresh and gory, and claims the pot. All the foregoing is quite true, and yet there are white men who have lived in the Solomons a score of years, and who feel homesick when they go away from them. A man needs only to be careful and lucky to live a long time in the Solomons, but he must also be of the right sort. He must have the hallmark of the inevitable white man stamped upon his soul. He must be inevitable. He must have a certain grand carelessness of odds, a certain colossal self-satisfaction, and a racial egotism that convinces him that one white is better than 1,000 niggers every day in the week, and that on Sunday he is able to clean out 2,000 niggers. For such are the things that have made the white man inevitable. Oh, and one other thing, the white man who wishes to be inevitable must not merely despise the lesser breeds and think a lot of himself. He must also fail to be too long on imagination. He must not understand too well the instincts, customs, and mental processes of the blacks, the yellows, and the browns, for it is not in such fashion that the white race has tramped its royal road around the world. Bertie Arkwright was not inevitable. He was too sensitive, too finely strung, and he possessed too much imagination. The world was too much with him. He projected himself too quiveringly into his environment. Therefore, the last place in the world for him to come was the Solomons. He did not come, expecting to stay. A 5-week stopover between steamers, he decided, would satisfy the call of the primitive he felt thrumming the strings of his being. At least, so he told the lady tourists on the Makembo, though in different terms. And they worshipped him as a hero, for they were lady tourists and they would know only the safety of the steamer's deck as she threaded her way through the Solomons. There was another man on board, of whom the ladies took no notice. He was a little shriveled wisp of a man, with a withered skin the color of mahogany. His name on the passenger list does not matter, but his other name, Captain Malu, was a name for niggers to conjure with, and to scare naughty Pekinese to righteousness from New Hanover to the New Hebrides. He had farmed savages and savagery, and from fever and hardship, the crack of Snyders and the lash of the overseers, had wrested 5 millions of money in the form of G.D. myrrh, sandalwood, pearl shell and turtle shell, ivory nuts and copra, grasslands, trading stations, and plantations. Captain Malu's little finger, which was broken, had more inevitableness in it than Bertie Arkwright's whole carcass. But then, the lady tourists had nothing by which to judge save appearances, and Bertie certainly was a fine-looking man. Bertie talked with Captain Malu in the smoking room, confiding to him his intention of seeing life red and bleeding in the Solomons. Captain Malu agreed that the intention was ambitious and honorable. It was not until several days later that he became interested in Bertie, when that young adventurer insisted on showing him an automatic 44 caliber pistol. Bertie explained the mechanism and demonstrated, by slipping a loaded magazine up the hollow butt. "It is so simple," he said. He shot the outer barrel back along the inner one. that loads it and cocks it, you see. And then all I have to do is pull the trigger 8 times as fast as I can quiver my finger. See that safety clutch? That's what I like about it. It is safe. It is positively foolproof. He slipped out the magazine. You see how safe it is. As he held it in his hand, the muzzle came in line with Captain Malu's stomach. Captain Malu's blue eyes looked at it unswervingly. Would you mind pointing it in some other direction? He asked. It's perfectly safe, Bertie assured him. I withdrew the magazine. It's not loaded now, you know. A gun is always loaded. But this one isn't. Turn it away just the same. Captain Malu's voice was flat and metallic and low, but his eyes never left the muzzle until the line of it was drawn past him and away from him. I'll bet a fiver it isn't loaded, Bertie proposed warmly. The other shook his head. Then I'll show you. Bertie started to put the muzzle to his own temple with the evident intention of pulling the trigger. Just a second, Captain Malu said quietly, reaching out his hand. Let me look at it. He pointed it seaward and pulled the trigger. A heavy explosion followed, instantaneous with the sharp click of the mechanism that flipped a hot and smoking cartridge sidewise along the deck. Bertie's jaw dropped in amazement. I slipped the barrel back once, didn't I? He explained. It was silly of me, I must say. He giggled flabbily and sat down in a steamer chair. The blood had ebbed from his face, exposing dark circles under his eyes. His hands were trembling and unable to guide the shaking cigarette to his lips. The world was too much with him, and he saw himself with dripping brains prone upon the deck. Really, he said. Really. It's a pretty weapon, said Captain Malu, returning the automatic to him. The commissioner was on board the Makembo, returning from Sydney, and by his permission a stop was made at Uji to land a missionary. And at Uji lay the Ketcharla, Captain Hansen, skipper. Now the Yarla was one of many vessels owned by Captain Malu, and it was at his suggestion, and by his invitation, that Bertie went aboard the Yarla as guest for a 4 days recruiting cruise on the coast of Malaita. Thereafter the Yarla would drop him at Remensch Plantation, also owned by Captain Malu, where Bertie could remain for a week, and then be sent over to Tulagi, the seat of government, where he would become the commissioner's guest. Captain Malu was responsible for 2 other suggestions, which given, he disappears from this narrative. One was to Captain Hansen, the other to Mr. Harrywell, manager of Remensch Plantation. Both suggestions were similar in tenor, namely, to give Mr. Bertram Arkwright an insight into the rawness and redness of life in the Solomons. Also, it is whispered that Captain Malu mentioned that a case of scotch would be coincidental with any particularly gorgeous insight Mr. Arkwright might receive. Yes, Swartz always was too pig-headed. You see, he took 4 of his boat's crew to Tulagi to be flogged, officially, you know, then started back with them in the whaleboat. It was pretty squally, and the boat capsized just outside. Swartz was the only one drowned. Of course, it was an accident. Was it? Really? Bertie asked, only half interested, staring hard at the black man at the wheel. Uji had dropped astern, and the Yarla was sliding along through a summer sea toward the wooded ranges of Malaita. The helmsman who so attracted Bertie's eyes sported a 10-penny nail, stuck skewer-wise through his nose. About his neck was a string of pants buttons. Thrust through holes in his ears were a can opener, the broken handle of a toothbrush, a clay pipe, the brass wheel of an alarm clock, and several Winchester rifle cartridges. On his chest, suspended from around his neck, hung the half of a china plate. Some 40 similarly apparelled blacks lay about the deck, 15 of which were boat's crew, the remainder being fresh labor recruits. Of course it was an accident, spoke up the Yarla's mate, Jacobs, a slender, dark-eyed man who looked more a professor than a sailor. Johnny bet up nearly at the same kind of accident. He was bringing back several from a flogging when they capsized him. But he knew how to swim as well as they, and 2 of them were drowned. He used a boat stretcher and a revolver. Of course it was an accident. quite common, some accidents, remarked the skipper. You see that man at the wheel, Mr. Arkwright? He's a man-eater. 6 months ago, he and the rest of the boat's crew drowned the then-captain of the Yarla. They did it on deck, sir, right aft there by the mizzen traveler. The deck was in a shocking state, said the mate. Do I understand? Bertie began. Yes, just that, said Captain Hansen. It was an accidental drowning. But on deck? Just so. I don't mind telling you, in confidence, of course, that they used an axe. This present crew of yours? Captain Hansen nodded. The other skipper always was too careless, explained the mate. He but just turned his back when they let him have it. We haven't any showdown here, was the skipper's complaint. The government protects a nigger against a white every time. You can't shoot first. You've got to give the nigger first shot, or else the government calls it murder, and you go to Fiji. That's why there's so many drowning accidents. Dinner was called, and Bertie and the skipper went below, leaving the mate to watch on deck. Keep an eye out for that black devil, Aiki, was the skipper's parting caution. I haven't liked his looks for several days. Righto, said the mate. Dinner was partway along, and the skipper was in the middle of his story of the cutting out of the Scottish chiefs. Yes, he was saying, she was the finest vessel on the coast. But when she missed stays, and before ever she hit the reef, the canoes started for her. There were 5 white men, a crew of 20 Santa Cruz boys and salmons, and only the supercargo escaped. Besides, there were 60 recruits. They were all kai-kai'd. Kai-kai, oh, I beg your pardon. I mean they were eaten. Then there was the James Edwards, a dandy rigged, but at that moment there was a sharp oath from the mate on deck, and a chorus of savage cries. A revolver went off 3 times, and then was heard a loud splash. Captain Hansen had sprung up the companionway on the instant, and Bertie's eyes had been fascinated by a glimpse of him drawing his revolver as he sprang. Bertie went up more circumspectly, hesitating before he put his head above the companionway slide. But nothing happened. The mate was shaking with excitement, his revolver in his hand. Once he startled, and half jumped around, as if danger threatened his back. One of the natives fell overboard, he was saying, in a queer tense voice. He couldn't swim. Who was it? The skipper demanded. Aiki, was the answer. But I say, you know, I heard shots, Bertie said, in trembling eagerness, for he scented adventure, an adventure that was happily over with. The mate whirled upon him, snarling. It's a damned lie. There ain't been a shot fired. The nigger fell overboard. Captain Hansen regarded Bertie with unblinking, lackluster eyes. I thought, Bertie was beginning. Shots, said Captain Hansen, dreamily. Shots? Did you hear any shots, Mr. Jacobs? Not a shot, replied Mr. Jacobs. The skipper looked at his guest triumphantly, and said, evidently an accident. Let us go down, Mr. Arkwright, and finish dinner. Bertie slept that night in the captain's cabin, a tiny stateroom off the main cabin. The forward bulkhead was decorated with a stand of rifles. Over the bunk were 3 more rifles. Under the bunk was a big drawer, which, when he pulled it out, he found filled with ammunition, dynamite, and several boxes of detonators. He elected to take the settee on the opposite side. Lying conspicuously on the small table was the Yarla's log. Bertie did not know that it had been especially prepared for the occasion by Captain Malu, and he read therein how on September 21st, 2 boat's crew had fallen overboard and been drowned. Bertie read between the lines and knew better. He read how the Yarla's whale boat had been bushwhacked at Suu, and had lost 3 men, of how the skipper discovered the cook stewing human flesh on the galley fire, flesh purchased by the boat's crew ashore in Fiji, of how an accidental discharge of dynamite, while signaling, had killed another boat's crew, of night attacks, ports fled from between the dawns, attacks by bushmen in mangrove swamps, and by fleets of saltwater men in the larger passages. One item that occurred with monotonous frequency was death by dysentery. He noticed with alarm that two white men had so died, guests, like himself, on the Yarla. I say, you know, Bertie said next day to Captain Hansen. I've been glancing through your log. The skipper displayed quick vexation that the log had been left lying about. And all that dysentery, you know, that's all rot, just like the accidental drownings, Bertie continued. What does dysentery really stand for? The skipper openly admired his guest's acumen, stiffened himself to make indignant denial, then gracefully surrendered. You see, it's like this, Mr. Arkwright. These islands have got a bad enough name as it is. It's getting harder every day to sign on white men. Suppose a man is killed. The company has to pay through the nose for another man to take the job. But if the man merely dies of sickness, it's all right. The new chums don't mind disease. What they draw the line at is being murdered. I thought the skipper of the Yarla had died of dysentery when I took his billet. Then it was too late. I'd signed the contract. Besides, said Mr. Jacobs, there's altogether too many accidental drownings anyway. It don't look right. It's the fault of the government. A white man hasn't a chance to defend himself from the niggers. Yes, look at the princess and that Yankee mate. The skipper took up the tale. She carried five white men besides a government agent. The captain, the agent, and the supercargo were ashore in the two boats. They were killed to the last man. The mate and bosun, with about 15 of the crew, Salmons and Tongans, were on board. A crowd of niggers came off from shore. First thing the mate knew, the bosun and the crew were killed in the first rush. The mate grabbed three cartridge belts and two Winchesters, and skinned up to the cross trees. He was the sole survivor, and you can't blame him for being mad. He pumped one rifle till it got so hot he couldn't hold it, then he pumped the other. The deck was black with niggers. He cleaned them out. He dropped them as they went over the rail, and he dropped them as fast as they picked up their paddles. Then they jumped into the water, and started to swim for it, and being mad, he got half a dozen more. And what did he get for it? 7 years in Fiji, snapped the mate. The government said he wasn't justified in shooting after they'd taken to the water, the skipper explained. And that's why they die of dysentery nowadays, the mate added. Just fancy, said Bertie, as he felt a longing for the cruise to be over. Later on in the day he interviewed the black who had been pointed out to him as a cannibal. This fellow's name was Sumasai. He had spent 3 years on the Queensland plantation. He had been to Samoa, and Fiji, and Sydney, and as a boat's crew had been on recruiting schooners through New Britain, New Ireland, New Guinea, and the Admiralties. Also, he was a wag, and he had taken a line on his skipper's conduct. Yes, he had eaten many men. How many? He could not remember the tally. Yes, white men too. They were very good, unless they were sick. He had once eaten a sick one. My word, he cried, at the recollection. Me sick plenty along him. My belly walk about too much. Bertie shuddered, and asked about heads. Yes, Sumasai had several hidden ashore, in good condition, sun-dried, and smoke-cured. One was of the captain of a schooner. It had long whiskers. He would sell it for £2. Black men's heads he would sell for £1. He had some Pekanini heads, in poor condition, that he would let go for 10 bob. 5 minutes afterward, Bertie found himself sitting on the companionway slide alongside a black with a horrible skin disease. He sheered off, and on inquiry, was told that it was leprosy. He hurried below, and washed himself with antiseptic soap. He took many antiseptic washes in the course of the day, for every native on board was afflicted with malignant ulcers of one sort or another. As the Yarla drew into an anchorage in the midst of mangrove swamps, a double row of barbed wire was stretched around above her rail. That looked like business, and when Bertie saw the shore canoes alongside, armed with spears, bows and arrows, and sniders, he wished more earnestly than ever that the cruise was over. That evening the natives were slow in leaving the ship at sundown. A number of them checked the mate when he ordered them ashore. Never mind, I'll fix them, said Captain Hansen, diving below. When he came back, he showed Bertie a stick of dynamite attached to a fish hook. Now it happens that a paper-wrapped bottle of chlorodyne with a piece of harmless fuse projecting can fool anybody. It fooled Bertie, and it fooled the natives. When Captain Hansen lighted the fuse and hooked the fish hook into the tail end of a native's loincloth, that native was smitten with so an ardent a desire for the shore that he forgot to shed the loincloth. He started forward, the fuse sizzling and spluttering at his rear, the natives in his path taking headers over the barbed wire at every jump. Bertie was horror-stricken. So was Captain Hansen. He had forgotten his 25 recruits, on each of which he had paid 30 shillings advance. They went over the side along with the shore-dwelling folk, and followed by him who trailed the sizzling chlorodyne bottle. Bertie did not see the bottle go off, but the mate opportunely discharging a stick of real dynamite aft, where it would harm nobody, Bertie would have sworn in any admiralty court to a nigger blown to flinders. The flight of the 25 recruits had actually cost the Jarl £40, and, since they had taken to the bush, there was no hope of recovering them. The skipper and his mate proceeded to drown their sorrow in cold tea. The cold tea was in whiskey bottles, so Bertie did not know it was cold tea they were mopping up. All he knew was that the two men got very drunk and argued eloquently, and at length, as to whether the exploded nigger should be reported as a case of dysentery or as an accidental drowning. When they snored off to sleep, he was the only white man left, and he kept a perilous watch till dawn, in fear of an attack from shore and an uprising of the crew. 3 more days the Jarl spent on the coast, and 3 more nights the skipper and the mate drank over fondly of cold tea, leaving Bertie to keep the watch. They knew he could be depended upon, while he was equally certain that if he lived, he would report their drunken conduct to Captain Malou. Then the Jarl dropped anchor at Remensch Plantation, on Guadalcanal, and Bertie landed on the beach with a sigh of relief, and shook hands with the manager. M.R. Harrywell was ready for him. Now you mustn't be alarmed if some of our fellows seem downcast, Mr. Harrywell said, having drawn him aside in confidence. There's been talk of an outbreak, and 2 or 3 suspicious signs I'm willing to admit, but personally I think it's all poppycock. How many blacks have you on the plantation? Bertie asked, with a sinking heart. We're working 400 just now, replied Mr. Harrywell, cheerfully. But the 3 of us, with you, of course, and the skipper and mate of the Jarl, can handle them all right. Bertie turned to meet one McTavish, the storekeeper, who scarcely acknowledged the introduction, such was his eagerness to present his resignation. It being that I'm a married man, Mr. Harrywell, I can't very well afford to remain on longer. Trouble is working up, as plain as the nose on your face. The niggers are going to break out, and there'll be another Ohono horror here. What's a Ohono horror? Bertie asked, after the storekeeper had been persuaded to remain until the end of the month. Oh, he means Ohono plantation, Onisible, said the manager. The niggers killed the 5 white men ashore, captured the schooner, killed the captain and mate, and escaped in a body to Malaita. But I always said they were careless on Ohono. They won't catch us napping here. Come along, Mr. Arkwright, and see our view from the veranda. Bertie was too busy wondering how he could get away to Tulagi to the commissioner's house to see much of the view. He was still wondering when a rifle exploded very near to him, behind his back. At the same moment his arm was nearly dislocated, so eagerly did Mr. Harrywell drag him indoors. I say, old man, that was a close shave, said the manager, pawing him over to see if he had been hit. I can't tell you how sorry I am. But it was broad daylight, and I never dreamed. Bertie was beginning to turn pale. They got the other manager that way, McTavish vouchsafed. And a dashed fine chap he was. Blew his brains out all over the veranda. You noticed that dark stain there between the steps and the door? Bertie was ripe for the cocktail which Mr. Harrywell pitched in and compounded for him, but before he could drink it, a man in riding trousers and puttees entered. What's the matter now? The manager asked, after one look at the newcomer's face. Is the river up again? River be blowed, it's the niggers. Stepped out of the cane grass, not a dozen feet away, and whopped at me. It was a Snyder, and he shot from the hip. Now what I want to know, is where'd he get that Snyder? Oh, I beg pardon. Glad to know you, Mr. Arkwright. Mr. Brown is my assistant, explained Mr. Harrywell. And now let's have that drink. But where'd he get that Snyder? Mr. Brown insisted. I always objected to keeping those guns on the premises. They're still there, Mr. Harrywell said, with a show of heat. Mr. Brown smiled incredulously. Come along and see, said the manager. Bertie joined the procession into the office, where Mr. Harrywell pointed triumphantly at a big packing case in a dusty corner. Well, then where did the beggar get that Snyder, harped Mr. Brown. But just then McTavish lifted the packing case. The manager started, then tore off the lid. The case was empty. They gazed at one another in horrified silence. Harrywell drooped wearily. Then McVeigh cursed. What I contended all along, the houseboys are not to be trusted. It does look serious, Harrywell admitted, but we'll come through it all right. What the sanguinary niggers need is a shaking up. Will you gentlemen please bring your rifles to dinner, and will you, Mr. Brown, kindly prepare 40 or 50 sticks of dynamite. Make the fuses good and short. We'll give them a lesson. And now, gentlemen, dinner is served. One thing that Bertie detested was rice and curry, so it happened that he alone partook of an inviting omelet. He had quite finished his plate when Harrywell helped himself to the omelet. One mouthful he tasted, then spat out vociferously. That's the second time, McTavish announced ominously. Harrywell was still hawking and spitting. Second time, what? Bertie quavered. Poison, was the answer. That cook will be hanged yet. That's the way the bookkeeper went out at Cape March, Brown spoke up. Died horribly. They said on the Jesse that they heard him screaming 3 miles away. I'll put the cook in irons, sputtered Harrywell. Fortunately we discovered it in time. Bertie sat paralyzed. There was no color in his face. He attempted to speak, but only an inarticulate gurgle resulted. All eyed him anxiously. Don't say it, don't say it, McTavish cried in a tense voice. Yes, I ate it, plenty of it, a whole plateful. Bertie cried explosively, like a diver suddenly regaining breath. The awful silence continued half a minute longer, and he read his fate in their eyes. Maybe it wasn't poison after all, said Harrywell, dismally. Call in the cook, said Brown. In came the cook, a grinning black boy, nose spiked and ear plugged. Here, you, why, what name that? Harrywell bellowed, pointing accusingly at the omelet. Why was very naturally frightened and embarrassed. Him good fella kai, he murmured apologetically. Make him eat it, suggested McTavish. That's a proper test. Harrywell filled a spoon with the stuff and jumped for the cook, who fled in panic. That settles it, was Brown's solemn pronouncement. He won't eat it. Mr. Brown, will you please go, and put the irons on him? Harrywell turned cheerfully to Bertie. It's all right, old man, the commissioner will deal with him, and if you die, depend upon it, he will be hanged. Don't think the government'll do it, objected McTavish. But gentlemen, Bertie cried. In the meantime think of me. Harrywell shrugged his shoulders pityingly. Sorry old man, but it's a native poison, and there are no known antidotes for native poisons. Try and compose yourself and if... Two sharp reports of a rifle from without interrupted the discourse, and Brown, entering, reloaded his rifle and sat down to table. The cook's dead, he said. Fever. A rather sudden attack. I was just telling Mr. Arkwright that there are no antidotes for native poisons, except gin, said Brown. Harrywell called himself an absent-minded idiot, and rushed for the gin bottle. Neat, man, neat, he warned Bertie, who gulped down a tumbler two-thirds full of the raw spirits, and coughed and choked from the angry bite of it till the tears ran down his cheeks. Harry Will took his pulse and temperature, made a show of looking out for him, and doubted that the omelet had been poisoned. Brown and McTavish also doubted, but Bertie discerned an insincere ring in their voices. His appetite had left him, and he took his own pulse stealthily under the table. There was no question but what it was increasing, but he failed to ascribe it to the gin he had taken. McTavish, rifle in hand, went out on the veranda to reconnoiter. "They're massing up at the cookhouse," was his report. "And they've no end of snipers. My idea is to sneak around on the other side, and take them in flank. Strike the first blow, you know. Will you come along, Brown?" Harry Will ate on steadily, while Bertie discovered that his pulse had leaped up 5 beats. Nevertheless, he could not help jumping when the rifles began to go off. Above the scattering of snipers could be heard the pumping of Brown's and McTavish's Winchesters, all against a background of demoniacal screeching and yelling. "They've got them on the run," Harry Will remarked, as voices and gunshots faded away in the distance. Scarcely were Brown and McTavish back at the table when the latter reconnoitered. "They've got dynamite," he said. "Then let's charge them with dynamite," Harry Will proposed. Thrusting half a dozen sticks each into their pockets and equipping themselves with lighted cigars, they started for the door. And just then it happened. They blamed McTavish for it afterward, and he admitted that the charge had been a trifle excessive. But at any rate it went off under the house, which lifted up cornerwise and settled back on its foundations. Half the china on the table was shattered, while the 8-day clock stopped. Yelling for vengeance, the three men rushed out into the night, and the bombardment began. When they returned, there was no Bertie. He had dragged himself away to the office, barricaded himself in, and sunk upon the floor in a gin-soaked nightmare, wherein he died 1,000 deaths, while the valorous fight went on around him. In the morning, sick and head ashy from the gin, he crawled out to find the sun still in the sky and God presumable in heaven, for his hosts were alive and uninjured. Harry Will pressed him to stay on longer, but Bertie insisted on sailing immediately on the Yarlifer to Lodgy, where, until the following steamer day, he stuck close by the commissioner's house. There were lady tourists on the outgoing steamer, and Bertie was again a hero, while Captain Malou, as usual, passed unnoticed. But Captain Malou sent back from Sydney 2 cases of the best Scotch whiskey on the market, for he was not able to make up his mind as to whether it was Captain Hansen or Mr. Harrywell who had given Bertie Arkwright the more gorgeous insight into life in the Solomons.